consolidated, correct? So, K-Lab, various others, Southern Concepts versus Department of Aging and Disability, and for the appellants?
Yes.
Okay. All right, thank you. And Mr. Claiborne, you're here for the FLEs, correct?
Yes, sir.
If you all want to come on up and get set up. Our second case, and I'll let you folks know, we're going to need to take a short break in between the first and second case because we have a recomposition of our panel. So that is Facility Insurance Corporation versus Patients Medical Center. And for the appellant, Mr. Tipton. And for the FLE? All right, very good. Thank you. And if those of you in the audience would take just a moment and silence any electronic devices that you might have, I know the parties would appreciate that. And with that, and it's Benorden?
Yes, sir.
All right. Just whenever you're ready. Why don't you give them to the clerk here?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
I keep forgetting we have a recording device. Let me just go ahead and state for the record that we are calling 0317-711 and 12 CV.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court. We're ready. Okay. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here and representing the appellants in this case, who are providers who are being unjustly and unfairly and improperly attempted to be additionally taxed by the department. DADS is the facility. And so we appreciate this time to explain the error in the ways of the lower courts and also in the department's attempt to recoup an underpayment quaff tax. And so I understand you've studied the briefs and know those, and so I'm just going to cover the parts that maybe need more clarification that seem to be more confusing to the courts down below and to the department. But before I do that, there is one thing I want to make especially clear, and it's in the exhibit here, is that there's no evidence anywhere or insinuation or in any way indicated that any appellant did anything inappropriate, that they could try to mislead or fraudulently submit data or did anything wrong. The only evidence before this court is that all of the appellants followed all of the rules and the regulations and the instructions of the department as they supplied information to the department for them to calculate the quaff tax, quality assurance fee tax. And so the first exhibit page in the exhibit that I've given you is just a highlight of a portion of a sentence in a letter that was sent to each appellant that confirms that DADS acknowledges that Southern Concepts and each appellant received the same letter, followed the practices of DADS, HHSC, TDMHMR, in its payment of the quaff. And then the next exhibit I've highlighted here on page 2 is an affidavit in the Southern Concepts matter, but each of the appellants have a similar record and a similar affidavit where they swore, and this is uncontroverted, that during the relevant time period, they filed the required reports and made timely and accurately quaff payments according to the deadlines and procedures provided to their company by the department, who was responsible for administering the quaff program at the time. She also swore, and they all swore, that during the years these payments were made, and this is a 3-year time period that we're talking about, that the quaff taxes were assessed and paid, that their company did not receive any notice from HHSC that they underpaid, and that there was never a demand for underpayments. So what happened, the rule was in place in 2003, we have them administering the co-op program, and then after a federal audit in around 2008, the rules were amended. And as a result of all that, after that time period, the department has tried to come back and collect these underpayments of the co-op tax. So they, you know, and I'm going to explain in kind of a summary fashion how they calculated that so that you can see, better understand the rule. But one thing I do want to point out is that the department, throughout the briefings in the various levels of the courts, have, they keep citing the 2008 law. It's the 2003 law that's applicable here. And I think that has kind of perpetuated some confusion. And also, in their briefing, they keep citing the 2008 law, and they're not quoting the law correctly either, nor do they apply it correctly. And so what I did is, in this exhibit on page 4 that I sent to you, I highlighted a portion out of Appley's brief to this court. And they are purporting to quote the rule that I have created a demonstrative on the next page, but the 2003 rules, but they left out a significant portion of that rule that is kind of the crux of where we have the problem here. And I've highlighted the portion that they left out. So the highlighted portion in this, like on page 4, is what was not included in the brief, not included in the brief to you, but is significant language related to how to calculate the co-op tax and how they did it. And so just going through that, we can see that the quality assurance fee, the QAF for a facility, is 6% of each reimbursement or payment rate received. So you'll see some other references to it being 6%, but it's 6% of each reimbursement or payment rate received based on a calendar month. That's the significant language that was left out, and then provided that the amount over an annual basis that was paid does not exceed 6% of the facility's total annual gross receipts. So all those words are significant. Is 6% of the reimbursement or payment rate received, and does not exceed 6% of the gross receipts.
So the reconciliation that would take place is just to ensure that the fee paid did not exceed the
6%. Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor, and that takes me to the next page, and I'm also going to explain kind of or expound upon in the affidavit how the co-op tax actually worked. So what happened is, and you could turn the page and hear the rules, 2003 and 2008, but what actually happened is on the 10th of every month, the department requested that each appellant provide certain information, how many beds they would have for residents, level of need, other additional information, and they all knew that this was going to be projected till the end of the month. Now, things may change, but anyway, they were asked to submit projected amounts on the 10th of the month. So during the next 10 days, on the 20th of the month, the department would calculate, and it did it on a cash basis, and it calculated the 6% of each reimbursement or payment rate received based upon the data they asked for. On the 20th of the month, they calculated the 6% QAF, and then they asked the appellants to pay it by the 30th of the month, which they did. Then the next month, it happened again on the 10th. The projected information was submitted to the department. They did everything they did. They would say on the 20th, here's how much you owe, and each appellant would pay that amount. So what would happen after 6 months? That's where this language comes in. They're required to do a reconciliation. So they add up each month's QAF amount that was calculated under the rules. And then they were supposed to see if that exceeded 6%. So they were given authority under the 2003 rules to, it may be adjusted, the QAF total may be adjusted to ensure that it not exceed 6%. See, there's no authority given to them to make sure it equaled 6%. And we can see when we look at the 2008 language how there did, the language came to become a flat tax, right? And this is on the annual revenue, too. There's a, you know, a kind of a misunderstanding. The 6% was for the monthly, And then the gross receipts or the annual revenue is what it should not exceed, you know, up to the 6%. And so that's what was done, you know, for 3 years. Now, then there was a federal audit. You probably saw that report. It's submitted in the other exhibits. And they determined that, you know, a proper reconciliation process was not being completed by the department. And so out of that review, some information came. There were some statements were made that, well, why didn't you collect underpayments? You know, well, for one, they stated at the time that their interpretation of their rules was that they had no authority to do that, that the collection of underpayments was unenforceable, that the law was vague with respect to underpayments, and so they couldn't collect those. And they never did, and they never tried during the time period, as the affidavit says.
Because so then, there was no C-4 type of a paragraph.
Exactly, exactly. Okay. Yeah, so you turn on the page, and yes, and that's where that amendment was.
Okay.
And so just going through, well, I'm going to go through the 2008 rule just because it's instructive as to what the 2003 really says.
Well, but what's the difference between maybe adjusted in the 2003 rule? I mean, granted, it's not a specific procedural steps like in C4 in the 2008 rule, but it still allows for maybe adjusted. What's the difference?
Well, I would just say it's the specific statutory rule language. It says it may be adjusted to ensure that it does not exceed.
Right.
Right? It's not adjusted to ensure that it equals, which is what the rules were amended to say in 2008, and you can see that on the next paragraph, that they were given the power to adjust to ensure that the fee equals 5.5%, it was changed down, of annual gross receipts. Now, another problem that arises in all of this, in 2003, gross receipts were calculated on a cash basis. You know, and there's a letter that I have as an exhibit here that says it used to be on a cash basis. Now we're going to count these calculate these gross receipts on an accrual basis. You know, and then we see the letter from the department that says we've gone back and we've calculated all your underpayments based upon gross receipts. But that's not appropriate under this rule, right? It was 6% of the monthly calculation.
But what's the significance in between the cash basis versus accrual in the not to exceed?
Well, the significance turns out to be just for our appellants, you know, $175,000 is when it was recalculated. They were asked their underpayments equaled, you know, that amount of money. So quite significant for these providers.
I'm sorry. What is the significance of using the legal significance of saying, not the result, but of saying cash basis versus accrual?
Okay. So accrual basis. So cash basis is at some point, the calculation, the percentages on all the money that the provider received, right? They were getting paid each month for taking care of these individuals. So if they received that amount, then that was used for the calculations. Now, the accrual amount just means, okay, something that the department decided that they were going to get, but they hadn't yet gotten. So you can see that might be a higher number if you're going to base it on an accrual method versus what you actually receive. Because in the interim, what would happen in the 6 months, you know, there are various methods of the way that they calculated the reimbursements that the providers would have. There's tons of factors. And they would do all these other calculations, and they would allow informal reviews to happen, and the department might decide they're going to give more, you know, overall compensation or less, and then that was allowed to be appealed if needed. So the actual cash received was always, well, the accrual amount was different, right? So they based it in 2003, the relevant time period, on what was actually received, not what was owed. And so that's kind of where it gets all mixed up when you're, you know, looking back at the amounts on the cash basis. You know, by the time they went to recalculate this, and we can see that it was supposed to be on the cash basis for the 2003 calculations, it was past the time which all of the many of the providers were required to keep their records. So, you know, they didn't have records to go back and be able to say, hey, no, that's not the base, it's not 6% of the reimbursement or payment received, you know, and talk about their gross receipts, and that's talked about in the affidavit as well. So I can keep going unless, okay. Did I answer your question?
I think so.
Okay. So we see that the 2008 amendments allowed specifically for underpayments to be taken from the providers, and that's what they did, and that's what the providers paid ongoing. So, you know, the cash and accrual basis is in my exhibit, page 7. I highlighted that. You know, there was the amendment rules. And then what I've done is, you know, as a on page 9 of my exhibits, I've highlighted the places where the ALJ's decision is plainly erroneous, clear legal error, because there is this confusion in the court as well as to the 6% of the gross receipts versus it equals 6% of the amount reimbursed, you know, and then the reconciliation total not to exceed 6%.
Are you talking about conclusion of law, which...
Yes, okay, so starting on page 9, so we see here on page 10, you know, required the providers to pay coif equal to 6% of the facility's gross receipts in Texas. But as I showed you earlier, it's 6% of the monthly calculation and then add it all up, not to exceed the 6% of the total gross receipts. So there was never a flat tax in 2003, but there became a flat tax in 2008. The other clear error is that in describing the federal audit that happened, there's references and briefings in here that the feds mandated and required the department to come back and collect these underpayments, but that's not true. The language is not in the report. It was permissive. And it was, you know, there was a great consequence because they determined that the department wasn't applying the tax uniformly, which was, or they said, you know, it may not be uniform, so therefore you might be in violation of losing all of your coif taxes, I don't know, millions over this time
that
period.
That doesn't necessarily implicate you all, does it?
No. Well, how it implicated us is, no, it wouldn't. It implicates the money that the department receives from the federal government.
Legally, that...
Right.
Right, so but this
relationship between the state and the federal government sort of irrelevant as it pertains to relationship between you all and the state government.
Yes, that's absolutely true. But what happened is the department said we were required, we were mandated to come get these things, and that it had to be 6% and it had to equal, which was improper and clear error in conclusion and exercise of their authority. So that's what I've stated. Out of time.
Go ahead and finish here.
And so I've just gone through. The final point I was going to make is that, you know, the impetus for collecting all of this underpayment was because they wanted the tax to be uniform. But they even stated in the federal report that they might not even be able to make it uniform. You know, they wanted a 6% flat tax, but they were saying we might not even be able to get 6% from everybody. And then this judge, in the opinion, didn't even order them to get 6%. It says you can get up to 6%. So it's like all of this, you know, craziness happens when it's not even the reason for it to receive uniform taxation on all providers is not even going to happen. So thank you. Anything else?
Thank you, Ms. Menarden.
May it please the court. Your Honor, this case, in its essence, is very simple, and that is just because HHSC, now formerly DADS, didn't properly reconcile the gross annual receipts with the monthly reports and fee calculations made by the facility and paid by the facility, just because they dropped the ball doesn't excuse responsibility for paying the fee in this case. And Your Honor, we're asking the court to affirm the trial court's order because it is not affected by any error of law, and the evidence supporting that administrative order is uncontroverted, as reflected in the order. The evidence that the court, that the LJ looked at, was applying one TAC 352.3, the law in effect at the time, And under that analysis, looking at the affidavit that appellants pointed out in their own statements, they says, we followed the rules. No one's debating that. However, they aptly describe in paragraph 8 of their affidavit that process from their end of the spectrum, when they're saying, oh, we have to report. The rule requires us to calculate the fee. It requires us to pay the fee. So they did that using the cash basis, based on the amount of money they had on hand, not based on the amount of money of, I would call it, accounts payables, not money that was still in the pipeline that they didn't have on hand. They calculated a 6% fee. Yes, Your Honor?
How long could dads go back and get these amounts?
Your Honor, the relevant period here was back to 2004.
Right. But I mean, how long can you go back and do this kind of thing where the agency itself is the one that made the error?
Your Honor, in reviewing the statute in question, which is Health and Safety Code 252, and the rule, which is one type, Section 352, there does not appear to be any statute of limitations recited in the statute or the rules.
Does it matter that there was no procedure for, as counsel's pointed out, like in C4, the procedures for going back and making the adjustments for overpayments or underpayments?
Your Honor, I think the question is, it always matters to have procedures to put people on notice of what they're likely to be subjected to. There's no question about that. However, in this case, the absence of those procedures, again, if you look at the actions of the parties involved, as recited in the CMS report, they talked about failings of the agency and failings of the facilities. Those failings is what brought about the result, which was they failed to collect underpayments. Even though they reconciled, they refunded overpayments. They also, and the facilities themselves, I'm not saying these particular facilities, but CMS noted that some facilities, particularly the larger ones, would delay filing their Medicaid reimbursement claims, and therefore the result was a reduction in the QAF cash on hand, and the fee would be lower that they pay. So the whole scheme here, if you read the statute carefully and the rules, the reason they base the 6% annual gross receipts is to catch all of that. 6% annual, that's 12 months of receipts. It's not monthly. It's not 6 months. It's 12 months of receipts that they have to use as a comparison point. Yes,
sir. Do you agree that prior to 2008 it was up to 6%, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The amount to be reconciled, it was to be reconciled to make sure it was up to 6%. In other words, it didn't exceed 6%, correct, before 2008?
Correct, Your Honor. The statute says that the agency can set the reimbursement rate up to 6%. In the rule that was adopted in 2003 and subsequently amended in 2008, they set the rate at 6%. The amount is 352.3. Section B says it is in an amount of 6%. That means that the rate is 6%, but they could not set a rate greater than 6%.
So you're saying that an explicit statement is made that it is 6%.
Yunner.
Not that it does not exceed 6%, because those are two very different things, are they not?
They are two different things, Yunner. And that's why this statute requires a close reading, is because the language says in the amount, it's 6%, in the amount of 6%, which is not the same as equal 6% or any other language. It's just exactly what it says. It's in the amount of 6%. However, when they go through the reconciliation process and compare what was paid to what the 6% of the gross receipts for the 12 months, when they compare those, you're going to end up with, in some cases, an overpayment, in some cases, an underpayment. And in this instance, the agency wasn't collecting those underpayments.
Well, let me ask this. Specifically, which rule did these folks not comply with, and specifically, how did they violate the rule?
Your Honor, as counsel noted, they complied with what they believed was the proper process as explained to them at the time by HHSC. They did what they were supposed to do. Now, as far as what they did in terms of how that rule, how 353.3, the 2003 version.
Sounds an awful lot like these people fully complied with everything that was told to them. We screwed up, and now some number of years later, we're going to come back.
After we amend the rule.
That seems like at some point you just run into a basic due process problem there.
Your Honor, the based on the record in this case, yes, the agency, and it's throughout the record, they are not disputing that they didn't collect underpayments. They should have collected underpayments. But because they didn't collect those.
They being the agency?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. They should have collected the underpayments in pursuant to the 2003 rule?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Where does it say that?
Your Honor, the rule, and I have it here under tab, tab 8.
Okay.
And there's a specific provision that deals with collection. And that is, 352.5, payment and collection of quality assurance fee. Again, it's in the first 3.2.5, it says that the facility has to pay the fee. And again, according to the instructions of the agency. In number 4, it says the commission or designee may review the calculation of the fee to ensure its accuracy and instruct the facility to correct its calculation and payment. So there, the facility does the initial calculation. They do the reporting based on how much, in this case, they did based on how much money they had on hand at the time of delivering report. But that's subject to review. That's subject to adjustment after the fact.
Why don't you have to read that in conjunction with 352.3C, which says the adjustment following the review is to ensure that the quality assurance fee does not exceed 6% of the annual revenue. Why don't those two things have to be read together?
Your Honor, I think you do have to read them together. I agree with the court that in the process of discerning whether there was that the fee was accurate, if it exceeds the 6% annual. Now, if you do this at 6 months, you won't have 12 months worth of data available. So you're going to have to do this at 12 months or thereafter. And at that point in time, when you do the 12-month, the calculation based on the 12-month gross receipts, then and only then will you actually know whether there's an overpayment or underpayment. And, Your Honor, it's also significant to note that the in 352.6 on enforcement, Part B, it says the commission may not grant exceptions from the quality assurance fee. So to the extent that they fail to collect the underpayments, the effect would be an exception from having to pay that fee.
They did it to everybody, so how would that be an exception? I mean, they did it universally from 2003 to 2008, so how is that an exception?
You know, I think the evidence there was based on the CMS report. Again, that would be under tab 1. And what the CMS noted, and I'm looking at its base stamp.
Well, and I was, so are you saying that The 2003 Act unambiguously says we can go back and collect these old things that we forgot to get before. I mean, there's...
Yes, Your Honor, I'm saying there's no limitations listed in the statute or the rule that says that these fees are no longer collectible after a specific date. The money, again, belongs to the state. Number one, the state has the right to that money based on the statute. The statute, and I'll point the court out to Chapter 252, which I believe is under Tab 7, which is really where everything should begin in terms of to the extent that there's any inconsistency between the rule or how one would interpret the rule, the statute will prevail in this case. And when you look at the 252.204, it has page 41 at the bottom under Tab 7, it says that the commission shall collect the quality assurance fee. It shall collect the fee. It doesn't say more than that, but that is a pretty definitive statement on its duty, which is to collect the fee. And it, in addition to that, in 252.
And it's up to the agency to define the process for collecting that fee, correct, and render its interpretation of the statute, and courts generally defer to that, and the commission did that, set forth these rules, and you've stated that as per the rules that were established, these folks complied with those rules front to back.
Your Honor, they complied with the rules to the extent of paying the fee. That's one step in the whole process. There's the reporting of gross receipts.
Did they fail to comply in that regard with the reporting of their gross receipts?
Your Honor, there's no evidence that they failed to comply, but there is evidence in the record that many times the records were incomplete. And if that's based on the CMS report, that sometimes there weren't records to support the whole idea of having a fee. What the CMS report discerned was that sometimes that fee was artificially low. The amount that they end up reporting as the fee was artificially low because of delaying the Medicaid claims, which would go to CMS. Delay those claims, you get a lower amount of cash on hand because that money's still in the pipeline, so you pay a lower fee. These were the manipulations that were going on within the context of the process. In the first instance, the facility is required to recalculate its own fee and report and pay that fee. In the second instance, the department then reviews that for accuracy. And if it needs to be adjusted at that time, they should have made a demand for the fee. However, they dropped the ball. They only paid refunds. They didn't ask for underpayments. And that absence of underpayments skewed all the numbers. And so, as the CMS report points out, yes, Your Honor?
Isn't that the point of 352.3C, where it says not later than July 31st, 2002, and then every 6 months thereafter this reconciliation we made? I mean, isn't in effect 352.3C almost a limitation on the agency of the timing it has to go through and make this reconciliation just to keep the agency from doing what it's doing here, which is going back 4 years and saying, by the way, 4 years ago you owed us this money and you never paid it, pay up?
Your Honor, I think that's a plausible interpretation. However, there's no evidence in the record that they didn't conduct the 6 months reconciliation. What was shown was that they conducted the 6 months reconciliation, but they didn't ask for payment of the underpayments. They just paid the refunds if they were over. So this is a look back over what's already been established. This is an audit of sorts.
I'm just thinking, if I'm a business owner and I've got a rule that I'm under that says every 6 months you department are going to reconcile my books to make sure my payment's correct. I mean, why can't at that point I rely on the agency to say, okay, you're telling me I'm doing everything right, 6 months, I'm not going to hold any back now. I'm going to continue to do my business and operate my business. I'm not going to hold any back thinking that you might come back 4 years later. I'm going to depend on that 6 months reconciliation. I mean, isn't that the way the system works for these providers?
Your Honor, in an ideal situation, I agree with the court's view.
In absent federal intervention, isn't that the way it would have continued to work?
Your Honor, I do not know if that would have continued or if what would have happened. However, the CMS report also shows that some of the facilities actually paid their fair share. And that's what created this lack of uniformity amongst the tax, because some facilities actually did the right thing and on the front end properly calculated their QAF. And these are the smaller facilities. The smaller facilities, the ones that couldn't afford to risk the very thing that you just described, Your Honor. But the larger facilities, they were able to slow some processes down, to fudge the numbers a little bit, pay a little bit lower fee on the front end, and then catch up.
We don't have any of that. We have no indication that any of that is going on here, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. But that is the impetus for what created the federal. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, and where it was kind of going to kind of get eventually was, isn't that CMS just some indication of a gap in the DAD's rules, or a gap or an ambiguity in the DAD's rules that the feds had to step in and say, hey, guys, you're doing this wrong? And so from 2008 on, now we're going to get it right?
Your Honor, again, that the CMS report did disclose problems that where the agency wasn't collecting those underpayments, yes. But the question is, does that transfer title of the money back to the facility? Because the debt, in this case, belongs to the state. It belongs to the Quality Assurance Fund.
So was DADS prevented from collecting underpayments in 2003 to 2008, and it just... that it was prevented from doing so until this other rule was enacted, or they just failed to do it?
Your Honor, according to the record, they just didn't do it.
Exactly.
And Your Honor, but again, as the ALJ's order said, it does not obviate their liability, the facility's liability for paying that fee. That fee has to be collected, and there cannot be any exceptions. That is the statutory law. By allowing the facilities to keep the fee, which doesn't belong to them, there's consequences. One is you create an exception. Two, another consequence is the very purpose of the fee was to have money in the fund. Based on the amount of that money, they would then have a federal draw, federal match. And that's where CMS got involved. And the more money in the fund, the more money available to increase the reimbursement rates for the facilities. So early, Your Honor, you asked, what does it matter more or less? I'm paraphrasing again, as far as the feds versus the state relationship here. Well, Your Honor, it matters, because they, by having more money to reimburse for the rate they charges, they would actually benefit as well from having put those fees in that fund. But in a way, they're reducing the amount of funds that are going into those fees, even though some facilities paid their fair share. Here, there's less money to use to increase the reimbursement rates from the Quality Assurance Fund. There's less money that can be used to improve the lives of individuals with intellectual disabilities, because they aren't paying their fair share. And that's all this is about, Your Honor, is them paying their fair share, just like the ones who did pay their fair share. And this is based, again, on analysis of the CMS report. So that's what this case is really about. They had that money, they owed that money, and they still owe that money. They have an obligation to pay that money to the fund. So says Chapter 252 of the Health and Safety Code. There cannot be any exceptions. Irrespective of HHSC, as they said, they didn't properly interpret and apply the requirements of the law. Nevertheless, the facility had a duty in the first instance to properly report, to properly calculate, and to properly pay the fee. That's their responsibility. That's not the state's responsibility. The state's responsibility was to review and audit and collect the fee. They failed to ask for those underpayments, so they didn't fulfill their obligation. However, in the first instance, the facility had a duty under this statute to properly report, properly calculate, properly pay that fee. And that's what we have here. Their duty is not the state's duty under the statute or under the rules. Their failure to pay has consequences, not only to themselves because they would get a lower reimbursement rate. You know, I see my time's up. I'm going to ask the court to affirm the trial court. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Faber.
Do I get five?
Yes, ma'am.
Again, thank you for hearing us today. And, you know, there's still confusion. When counsel referred to they, he referred several times to they as dads and to they as the facilities, and those are two different people. As you have seen and the evidence shows, that our appellants did nothing wrong. They weren't the providers in CMS who tried to fraudulently wiggle the numbers or whatever. Our clients did everything they were asked. The only evidence before this court is that they did everything they were asked according to the rules and instructions and information that dads put upon them, the requirements. The facilities did not calculate the fee. They were told, based upon the information they gave, what they were to pay, and they did that. That calculation was done by dads. And so, you know, what happened? They, during that relevant time period, they said, this is the law. We can't get underpayments. We're going to do this 6% on the monthly calculation, not to exceed in the reconciliation the 6 months. I mean, that was their law, and they interpreted at the time, applied it at the time, and collected all the fees that they wanted at the time. It's only when they were called out by the federal government that there may be some things wrong, maybe other people were doing something wrong, no evidence here of that, that they decided they needed to come back and reinterpret the rules.
Did you ever have a situation where dads would come back after more than 6 months to do a reconciliation?
That is not in the record, no. Because okay. It was every 6 months. And I know counsel referred to these other rules, but all of the rules and the laws have to be construed together. You know, and dads interpreted it that it had to be done every 6 months, and they had no authority beyond that 6 months to reconcile. And to come back years later, you know, more than 5 years later, after they don't even have the records anymore, and to recalculate gross receipts based upon the data that the department had, you know, not based upon the data, the true data that they had, that had been in existence to report in the first place, it's just definitely capricious, arbitrary, unauthorized exercise of their discretion, and it's crazy that they should be able to come back at any time. And yes, the laws and the rules at the time should be construed together, and they had no authority at the time to go beyond the 6 month reconciliation period. And you know, some of the laws that were pointed out before, you know, even on in exhibit 7 for rule 252.201, you know, again, it says that the quaff should not exceed 6%, is not more than 6%. And then we see the regulation in 2003, how it was the monthly calculation that was the 6%. And then it was the reconciliation that was do not exceed 6%, and on a 6 month basis. You know, they just have no authority to go back now, years later, reinterpret the law because they got called out. You know, they stated that during that 3 years, they thought it was unenforceable and vague that they should be allowed to come back and get underpayments. That was their decision. And the businesses relied upon that decision. You know, they paid everything that they were asked. They relied upon that decision. They gained these property rights and the money that they had, reinvested, did other things with it. And then here they come back after the amendments in the 2008 law, and they want to reinterpret the law. They want to go back and prospectively apply these taxes, you know, affecting the substantial rights of these individuals in violation of the substantial evidence rule. And this, you know, in opposed to some of the briefing, this is not really about a factual weight of the evidence call by the lower court. This is a purely legal decision regarding...
This is that portion of the substantial evidence rule that talks about legal interpretations and arbitrary capricious behavior rather than weighing the evidence.
Yes, we're not asking you to substitute your judgment for the judgment of the court below. We're asking you to apply the law as it was written. You know, that the department be held to the authority that they had at the time, the authority that the statutes give them. They cannot exercise discretion that is not given to them. You know, and they were given, as we've said, the calendar month, the reconciliation. They cannot exercise authority beyond that. That's when they're improperly exercising authority beyond excessive, arbitrary, capricious, unwarranted. I've got my statute here. But I pointed out in the brief the various portions of the substantial evidence rule that are called into place here. And that is the clear error and the reason that we request this court to reverse the decision of the district court and the ALJ.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank
you. Ms. Norden, thank both of you for your argument. The case will be submitted for consideration. This time, we're going to take a very short recess to accomplish our recomposition.